Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It is easy to leave a burning building when it is on fire. But what if that building contains the very thing that gives you life, excitement, peace, joy, courage, and wonder? Will you be an agent of change, or do nothing and eventually leave? If you work in Catholic ministry, business, or education, and need quality content on your website or social media pages, contact The Simple Catholic for copywriting services at thesimplecatholic.blog and click on the writing services page for more information. The Church Militant needs soldiers against the enemy. Enlist The Simple Catholic in this fight for the truth. Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today.
We've arrived at hour two here of Catholic Answers Live. I'm Sherry Brownrigg in for Cy Kellett, still in Australia with some of the other great Catholic Answers apologists and evangelizing the entire country, or at least part of it. Okay. Here's the number if you want to get in with Jimmy Akin this hour, 888-318-7884. I've got some folks hanging on from last hour, Jimmy, and we'll get to them in just a minute. But you know, I've been thinking about your book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and, you know, a lot of folks are really talking about what a great read that is. We had someone last hour, it said they read it in one night, and cool. He wants more. But, and you said you're going to deliver, in a couple of years you'll have something that might be little more in-depth, but yeah. But, you know, I think it would be good to give people a little teaser on that. So here's a question that that might be in that category. What was the first book to be written in the New Testament?
We're not entirely clear on this. You will sometimes hear people say that the first books of the New Testament to be written were the letters of St. Paul, and that the Gospels, for example, were written quite a bit later. That is not what the evidence supports to my mind, and I talk about this in The Bible as a Catholic Book. I think that the Gospels were actually written in about the same period as St. Paul's letters. St. Paul's letters seem to have been written between A.D. 50, where the first one would have been either 1 Thessalonians or possibly Galatians, but more likely 1 Thessalonians, and then A.D. 66, when he would have written 2 Timothy a few months before his death in A.D. 67. So between A.D. 50 and 67 is when I think St. Paul's letters were written. The Gospels, it's a little hard to say when the first one was written. Mark was probably written sometime in the A.D. 50s, so say A.D. 55. And I think the evidence shows that John, surprisingly, was written by about A.D. 65. So I think the Gospels were written about over a 10-year period. But do any of the books precede St. Paul's letters? One of them might. One of them is the letter of James. And the letter of James, when you study it carefully and open-mindedly, seems quite primitive. In terms of it doesn't reflect some of the developments in church history that happened later. There's an argument to be made that it might actually be earlier than some of St. Paul's letters. It could have been written maybe by A.D. 48, which would put it a couple of years earlier than Paul's first letter. One of the last books of the New Testament, to go to the other end of the spectrum, two of the last books were probably Hebrews, which seems to have been written around A.D. 67 or 68, and also the book of Revelation, which seems to have been written in the latter half of the year 68. So looks like the whole New Testament was written in about a 20-year period, maybe from AD 48 to AD 68. That's not a conclusive proof. There could have been individual books that are hard to date, like 2nd and 3rd John. They're so short, they just don't have enough time clues in them to pin them down real specifically. So there could have been some books that fell outside of that range, but that seems to be when the bulk of the New Testament was written.
That is just absolutely fascinating. I have such admiration for those who can actually look at the books in the Bible and understand all of that, you know, and look for the clues. You being one of them, Jimmy.
Well, thank you. I love detective stories, and it's a big detective story, looking for the clues and putting them together. And I guess it's part of my nature. In fact, I used to be a detective. I was a private detective for a while. So I've actually wrestled people to the ground to arrest them.
Well, maybe we'll get to see that someday on YouTube, right?
I hope not.
I hope it doesn't happen. Well, let's head to the phones now. Here's the number again, 888-318-7884. And Mike is first up, watching on YouTube Live. Hello, Mike. You're on the air with Jimmy. Mike, are you there?
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the air with Jimmy. What's your question today?
Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering, does the Catholic faith have an official position on cussing? Not like blasphemy and profanity, but everyday cuss words.
Okay. So the church recognizes, based on the Ten Commandments and other statements in Scripture, that we are to avoid words that take the Lord, that inappropriately use God's name or other references to God in an irreverent way. And so that means that it would rule out in principle what is technically known as profanity. Now, a lot of people are not familiar really with the difference between profanity and vulgarity, but it's an important distinction. Profanity involves taking something sacred and treating it as if it were not sacred. And so that would include so-called religious cuss words. Like if someone used the name Jesus Christ as a cuss word, that would be an example of profanity. Because Jesus Christ is sacred, and to treat his name as if it's not sacred would profane the name and thus be profanity. That's different than vulgarity. Vulgarity is the origin of the term is from the Latin word for common. It's the way common, rough, uneducated people might speak. And so this would include words that, refer to bodily functions. For example, words that begin with a variety of letters, which I won't go into because I'm sure you know them. But those body function words are words that unrefined common people might use from the perspective of the ancient elite. And so those would be vulgar terms that get used in vulgar society or common society, not in refined, polite society. And the church's concern really centers more on profanity. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, there is a section in the Ten Commandments where you can read more about this, and it really concerns more profanity than vulgarity. You do find in St. Paul an exhortation to stay away from filthy speech and stuff. That's not necessarily Paul saying this, you can never say something crass, because Paul himself says things that are crass. At one point, he is talking about his critics who are in favor of circumcision, and he says he wishes they would cut the whole thing off. And he's really quite crass about it. He wishes they would emasculate themselves. So, and you also have other body function words that get used in even in Scripture to talk about things. Like there's a description at one point of men in the Old Testament who are rather vulgar men, and they're described as those who use the bathroom on the wall, if I can put it rather delicately. In Hebrew, it's quite a bit less delicate than that. Also, you have the prophet Elijah taunting the prophets of Baal. And he's in common English versions, he's depicted as saying things to them like, cry out louder, maybe your god Baal is asleep or on a trip or something like that. And really, he in Hebrew, he doesn't say on a trip. He says maybe he's using the bathroom, but he says it in a not nice way. So you have even biblical authors using crass, what would be often be considered impolite or crass expressions at times. So there is a real difference between the prohibition on profanity and the counsel against vulgarity, at least in it's not as absolute. Having said that, there are also there's kind of a mixed class of what are sometimes known as minced oaths or pinched oaths. And this is where someone takes a word that is either profane or vulgar, and they don't want to go that far. They don't want to flat out say the word. And so they come up with a substitute that sounds kind of the same or has something like the same emotional resonance, but doesn't mean anything, or at least doesn't mean the same thing. And examples of this like would be, oh, for Pete's sake, instead of, oh, for God's sake, for example, mm-hmm. or saying sheesh instead of saying a body function word that begins with S. And these are by design even milder than the full-blown words. And so they need to correspondingly, that intent, we're trying to avoid going to the extreme, needs to be recognized in evaluating these. In terms of, it's also important to recognize that all of these terms have their meaning based on their context. In language, meaning doesn't come from origin, it comes from use. What people use a word to mean is what it means. And so words can change and even reverse meaning over the course of time. An example of a word that in English that's changed meaning dramatically is the word nice. It's based on the Latin word nescius, which means not knowing or ignorant. And if you say to a woman, you're wearing a nice dress, that does not mean remotely what it would have meant based on the Latin word nescius. It means something very different. It's a positive evaluation of the dress, not a negative one. So you have to look at what do these words mean to the people that are using them. And that brings to light an additional distinction between words that are taboo and words that are not taboo, or words that are polite and words that are considered impolite. Like I just used an expression a couple of times in this answer, using the bathroom. Well, that's a euphemism for certain body function terms that could be considered crass or vulgar. There are other examples where we have two words for the same thing in English. One of them is considered a polite word for it. Another is considered an impolite word for it. Excrement, for example, is considered a fairly clinical word for another word for the same thing, as indicated by another word that begins with the letter S. And excrement is a polite one because we need polite ways of referring to things. You need a way to tell your doctor about what's going on politely. So this just brings us back to the fact that it's really the intent of the people using these words that you have to look at in evaluating the morality of their usage, because it's going to change over time as words change meaning. It's going to change from person to person. It's going to depend on their knowledge of what the word means and what they're thinking about. And so it's really a pretty complex situation. In part, it's something that's hard to get rid of because use of words of this nature, either profane words or vulgar words, is a human universal. It occurs in every single human culture, and it seems to be connected with some very basic emotional functions that are hardwired into the human brain. There is, for example, what's known as the rage circuit that we have in our brains, to where when certain things that happen to enrage us, it's natural or feels almost unavoidable at times to just come out with one of these words to express how enraged we've suddenly become. And so there is something very deep in human nature, at least in its fallen state, that that needs or seeks to find expression through the use of vivid terms. And it can be really tricky at times to sort out, is this an appropriate usage? Because everyone needs to ways to say, I'm really mad, like, you know, St. Paul, for example. But it gets tangled up in these other areas where, because of human brokenness, we tend to blend it in with things that are sacred that should be treated as sacred. And so it's a delicate area, and most people, even though they shouldn't be using profanity, most people who are using profanity aren't aware of the full dimensions that it has or has to some people. And unfortunately, today we're living in a society that's fairly crass by historical standards. A lot of the old taboos have broken down, and so you hear these words a lot more than you used to, and you can't let your own peace be ruined by other people using these words, and you, to some extent, have to develop a thick skin to them.
Yeah. Well, great answer, Jimmy, and Mike, good question as well. And we are heading to a break here, but please know we've got a lot more to come here on this open forum with Jimmy Akin. A lot more questions lined up and room for yours at 888-318-7884. We'll be right back.
Atheists often argue they don't need to give reasons for their position because they simply lack a belief in God, the assumption being theists alone have the burden of proof. But is this rational? The answer is no, and here's the reason. Atheism can't simply be a lack of belief. Dogs lack belief in God, but that doesn't make dogs atheists. Atheism makes a claim about the world, namely, God doesn't exist. As such, atheists, along with theists, must shoulder the burden of proof. Even if an atheist says he simply hasn't found any good evidence for God, he would still have to prove why the evidence theists give for God is not good evidence. No matter how an atheist looks at it, he can't sit the sidelines when it comes to defending his position on the question of God's existence. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with program info, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. Just go to EWTN.com/wings, fill out your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. When you get yours, send it to all your friends, and they can send it to their friends, and pretty soon we're covering the whole world with the good news about EWTN. Wings, the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Here's that number again. You can never give it enough. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. The Bible is a Catholic book. You know, this is such a great book that Jimmy has written here. And, you know, it's interesting because the Bible itself is the most popular book in the history of the world. Maybe your book will give it a run for its money, Jimmy.
I doubt that.
I'm kidding.
I appreciate the thought.
Yeah, well, you know, they're good to get together.
Yeah.
But nobody really knows how we got it. And Catholics in particular, we are often unfamiliar with the Bible and its history. And really, one of the reasons why so many Catholics leave the church when they encounter a zealous anti-Catholic missionary who catches them off guard, you know, they make outrageous claims like the Catholic Church hates the Bible. That one kind of makes me laugh. It added to God's Word by putting false books in the Bible. No, it won't let you read it for yourself. Not true either. But really, for too long, the true story of how we got the Bible and the Catholic Church's role in it has been locked up in an inaccessible scholarly books. But now we've got Jimmy's book, and it is The Bible is a Catholic Book. It's an easy-to-read, popular-level discussion that unveils the actual facts. And as I said before, someone told us last hour, he read it in one night. Really accessible and good. It must be really, really good, Jimmy, if he wanted to read it all in one night.
Thank you. It is easy. It's not a long read. I believe the audiobook version of it is like 4.5 hours long. So it's not a long read.
Yeah, so you really can get it in one night. But you can get a free copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book. Just visit Catholic.com today. Click on The Bible is a Catholic Book. There's a tile at the bottom of the main page, and that'll show you how you can get that. And it's also on sale, too, in the shop at shop.catholic.com. All right, let's head back to the phones here. Denise is up next and listening on EWTN in Fairfield, Connecticut. Hello, Denise. You're on the air with Jimmy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with, we were talking a lot about the ancient Jews this evening, which is kind of coincidental, because as a catechist for several years in the past, I always got questions from my students about what happens to the Jews. They were God's chosen people. So upon Jesus' coming, what will be their fate?
Well, people of Jewish extraction are still have a special role in God's plan of the ages, so they're still his chosen people. The church also has a special role in God's plan, so it's also, Christians are also God's chosen people. God has more than one chosen people in that sense, and the two chosen people actually overlap because they're Jewish Christians. In terms of what's going to be the fate of a non-Christian Jew at the time of the second coming, well, it's going to be something like the fate of a Christian who's not a Jew. It's going to depend on his individual relationship with God. Now, Christians, by embracing the Christian faith, have at least in principle embraced the fullness of what God wants us to do, of the fullness of his will, because he wants everyone to be a follower of his son Jesus. That's why Jesus said, go among all the nations and make disciples. He has this universal call to embrace the Christian faith. That's what God wants everybody to do, whether they're Jewish or not. And if you do that, then that's great. If you fully embrace God's will, you'll be saved. But not all Christians do that. Some Christians, whether they're Jewish or Gentile, some Christians commit mortal sin. And if they die in that state, they're not going to be saved because they have rejected God's will in a fundamental way, knowingly and deliberately. Well, in terms of people who are Jewish and not Christian, they have certain graces on account of their membership in one of God's covenant people. St. Paul talks about how various gifts were given by God to the Jewish people and how these gifts and calling were irrevocable. So even though, and he talks about this in Romans 9 to 11, for example, he talks about how Jews who have not embraced Christ in his day maybe being disobedient to God, but nevertheless, they're still beloved on account of their forefathers who pleased God. And so God continues to bless them in various ways, in spite of the fact that they may individually have knowingly and culpably rejected faith in Christ. On the other hand, there are other people who are of various stripes, including non-Christian Jews, who have not rejected Christ through any fault of their own. They just may have been raised a certain way. They may never have been presented with good evidence that they should embrace Jesus. And so these people, whether they're Jewish or anything else, if they're not Christian through no fault of their own, but they otherwise live up to the degree of light and grace that God has shown them, then it's possible for them to be saved because they are responding on a fundamental level to God's will as they understand it, and they haven't done anything to deliberately, knowingly and deliberately close themselves off from God, so they can still receive his grace and still be saved on the last day. On the other hand, if they, like a Christian who's committing mortal sin, if they commit mortal sin, they knowingly and deliberately do something that's gravely immoral, well, then they're putting a barrier between themselves and God. And if they don't repent of that before they die, then they could be lost. And so it depends for both groups on both Christians and non-Christians on how you respond to what you know. And if you live up to the grace that you've been given, then whether that's a lot of knowledge of God or a little knowledge of God, you can be saved because you're still responding to God's grace. If you reject what you've been given, whether it's a lot that you're rejecting or a little that you're rejecting, then you jeopardize your salvation. So there's a sense in which God treats everybody equally. He holds you accountable to what you know and are responsible for, but he also helps people to where some people are fortunate to receive additional grace that it helps them out, and that is a good thing. So it's kind of like in the New Testament, we read salvation is first for the Jew, but then also for the Greek. And there's another sense in which you can apply that principle and say salvation is first for the Christian, but then also for all people who seek to follow God, even if they, through no fault of their own, are not Christian.
What do you think, Denise? Does that help?
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's extremely helpful. And right. I will share that with anyone who's asking.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Denise. We appreciate that. So we are going to be up against a hard break here, but maybe, Scott, if you can actually ask your question quickly, then Jimmy can answer it on the other side of the break. So, Scott, you're on the air.
I'm happy to do that. Jimmy, a lot of people, me included, say, I'm saved. So my question is, saved from what?
Well, it can be expressed in a number of ways. Saved from sin, saved from the guilt of having committed sin, saved from hell, saved from the devil. Frankly, anything that you can be rescued from is something that you can be saved from, because to save just means to rescue. And so when we're talking about going to heaven and being saved in that sense, well, the things that would keep you from heaven are sin, and that can be prompted by the devil, and the result of not going to heaven would be going to hell. So you could say, well, if I'm going to heaven, I'm saved from going to hell, I'm saved from the devil who tricked me into sinning and prompted me to sin, and I'm saved from the sins themselves.
Oh, Jimmy, you did it.
Say something else, or you have to go to break?
Scott, we're going to have to move on. I do apologize about that, but we're going to have to move on. We've got a lot of callers who are lined up here, but Jimmy, you did that one perfectly. That's wonderful.
Well, thank you. I try to be concise when I can.
Yeah. Well, it worked. All right. So thanks, Scott. We appreciate your call. Thomas and Clayton and Emma, you are up next. Here's that number, 888-318-7884. Call now to get that question in for Jimmy Akin on today's Open Forum here on Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.
Catholic Answers Live.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
You You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Today is an open forum with Jimmy Akin, and we still have a lot more to come here at 888-318-7884. That's the number for you to call to get on the air with Jimmy. Next up, we have Thomas in California. Hey, Thomas, you're on the air with Jimmy.
Hello, how are you doing, Jimmy?
Doing just fine.
Good to hear, good to hear. I'll get right to it since you have a lot of calls. My question is, what is the difference between a Catholic pastoral teaching and a Catholic church discipline? First of all, what are they, and then what are the differences between the two?
Okay, well, the first distinction is they fall in fundamentally different categories in that one is a teaching or a matter of doctrine, and the other is a discipline or a matter of practice. So, a discipline, a doctrine is something the church teaches. It's a claim the church says this is true. And it can say that with different degrees of force. It also can say it on different subjects and for different purposes. A pastoral teaching would be a teaching, something the church says is true, that would be motivated by pastoral concerns, like the good of people living in our age or facing some situation, or the proper pastoral care of souls, people should have access to the sacrament of confession or one of the other sacraments, for example, or things of that nature, things that are true that are directly connected with the pastoral care of individuals. Disciplines are matters of practice, and as the term discipline is ordinarily used, it refers to an obligatory practice, something that you really need to do. If you don't do it, then you're violating church discipline in some way. And so if you want the basic way to think about the difference between teachings and disciplines, or doctrines and discipline, one of them concerns truth, the other of them concerns practice. So truths and practices are the two key concepts here. These two concepts, though, are often linked. Sometimes you will have disciplines that are directly based on doctrines. For example, in marriage, we are expected to observe the discipline of fidelity. That is, we're to be faithful to our spouses. We are not to go around committing adultery. But this discipline of fidelity is based on a doctrine, a matter of teaching, that it is morally wrong to commit adultery, to be unfaithful to one's spouse. And in fact, that's a teaching that the church has taught very forcefully and even infallibly. In fact, since it's revealed to us by God in Scripture that it's immoral to sleep around on your spouse, it actually qualifies as a dogma in the proper sense of something God has revealed to us that has then been infallibly taught by the church as something God has revealed. So that's kind of a basic sketch of the difference between the two. I talk about all of this in considerable depth in a book I wrote called Teaching with Authority. And if you're really interested in understanding the distinctions here and how to identify, well, is this a discipline or is this a teaching or what kind of teaching is it, I would recommend that book. Is there a particular doctrine or teaching that you have in mind that you're wondering about?
Well, a lot of Catholics that I've talked to, they tell me, they talk about Vatican II and they talk about pastoral teachings, and I don't know if this is true or not. I mean, I think Vatican II is great. I think it's both valid and licit, but I hear that people will say that technically if the Pope wanted to, since they say that Vatican II was the only ecumenical council that was all pastoral teaching, that if he wanted that too, the Pope could change it just like that if he wanted to.
So there are a few problems there. The first one is Vatican II is not the only church council. So Vatican II is a church council that did not issue any new infallible definitions. But it's not unique in that respect. There have been other councils that did not issue any infallible definitions. And so that means all of the teachings of Vatican II, at least anything that was a new expression of teaching, is non-infallible and thus could potentially be changed. But that doesn't mean it's not authoritative, and that doesn't mean it can be dismissed merely as pastoral. In fact, if you look at the documents of Vatican II, you do have like the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world, and that just by its name tells you it's pastoral. But then you also have the dogmatic constitution on the church and the dogmatic constitution on divine revelation. And the name there tells you this is dogmatic. This is not simply pastoral. This is a matter of doctrine. And so, in both kinds of documents, actually, you have statements, even though they're not infallible, they are authoritative for our faith. And so you can't simply dismiss them. And a pope is simply not going to come around and just wave them away and say, oh, that doesn't matter, because it was an authentic exercise of the magisterium, including the pope at the time, Paul VI. So the idea that Vatican II only had to do with discipline and didn't have to do with church doctrine is not true. It is true it didn't say anything new that was infallible, but it's false to say that it is just dealing with pastoral matters or discipline and can simply be wished away or ignored on that basis. Again, teaching with authority will help you out a lot in understanding all that.
Excellent. No, I appreciate it. I'll have to take a look at that book.
Okay.
Yeah, highly recommend it. Thanks, Thomas. Appreciate that call. From there, we head to line six. Colleen is with us, and she is in Rhode Island. Hello, Colleen, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello. Thank you. I have a question about Psalm 122.
Okay.
And was it written by David? If so, when? And was crucifixion around at that time?
So let's deal with the second question first. Crucifixion has existed throughout human history. There have always been cases where someone was impaled or tied to or hung upon a stake, sometimes in the form of a cross. That's not unique to the ancient Near East. It's something that people have invented all over the world, but it's been relatively rare in many circumstances. And as far as I'm aware, it was not regularly practiced at the time of King David. Instead, when you read about people being put to death at that time, it tends to be by stoning. And it's real obvious if you go to Israel why stoning was such a common form of capital punishment, because the ground is covered with stones that you could just pick up and throw at somebody. So stoning was a very common form of putting people to death. Also, putting people to the sword or running them through with the sword was a common form of putting people to death. But we don't really read about people being crucified. We occasionally read about people being hung on a gibbet, but that's not necessarily the same thing as killing someone by crucifixion. And so, as far as I'm aware, crucifixion wasn't really common in David's time. It became common during the time of the Roman Empire. They used it a lot more than other cultures did in the area. In terms of, did David write Psalm 122? Well, Psalm 122 does have a prefix at the beginning of it that in Hebrew says L'Duid, and in Hebrew it means to or for or by. It's basically a preposition, but exactly what it means is ambiguous. And then David is just David's name in Hebrew. And so this could be translated as to David or by David or of David or for David or something like that. And scholars have debated what it means. In a lot of English translations, it'll be rendered of David, and that's typically understood by the English reader to mean it was written by David. But it's not necessarily what the ancient Hebrews would have understood it to mean, because prepositions mean different things in different languages. It's really hard frequently to translate prepositions accurately from one language to another, because they tend not to overlap with each other as well as other words. And scholars today have proposed different possible interpretations for what these Davidic Psalms mean, what those Davidic ascriptions mean. It may mean that it was written by David, in which case it would have been written during David's lifetime, and that was around 1000 BC when David lived, around 1000 BC. On the other hand, some people have some scholars have suggested that it might mean that it was written in honor of David, or it was written by someone in the same style as David's Psalms, or that it was written by the Davidic singers or by the Davidic composers at the temple, who, even though they weren't David, they were commissioned by him or were an institution that went back to him. So it's kind of ambiguous. There have been a bunch of different proposals. I think, based on my look at this area, because I've been fascinated by these ascriptions to David, I think that a lot of modern scholars are too quick to say, oh, it doesn't mean it was written by David. I think in many cases, it may well mean that it was written by David. But I do recognize that there are also arguments that can be made for other meanings, which also may apply in some of these cases. So I can't say in a particular case, was this definitely by David or not? But I don't rule it out as a possibility.
Colleen, fascinating question. Thank you so much for calling in and getting that on the air. We appreciate that. 888-318-7884. And still more to come here on Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum with Jimmy Akin, and we'll be right back.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I have wanted to thank you so very much. Thank God. Thank God you guys are here for us. Believe it. I just can't believe all that you've done and how you've stuck with it. Many times when I think I can't do something, I think about some of the things that you've talked about.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Here we are back for our final segment here on Catholic Answers Live. I'll give that number out one more time, 888-318-7884. Sherry Brownrigg in for Cy Kellett, who is still in Australia. And the Bible is a Catholic book. We now know that, but do you know why? Well, Jimmy Akin can actually teach you with a free course. You can go right now to Catholic.com. Click on Jimmy Akin's free video course. There's a little tile that you'll see near the bottom of the page. You can click on that and enroll today. It is free. Love that, Jimmy. Awesome. So let's head back to the phones now. We've got Lily up next. Lily is in Texas, and you are on the air with Jimmy Akin.
Yes. Hi. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. What's your question for Jimmy today?
So my question is, I'm a cradle Catholic. Got married about 8 years ago to a non-Catholic. And we had a non-denominational wedding, and everything was great. He was very interested in learning about the Catholic faith, and then decided that he wasn't, which was difficult.
Yeah.
And then he was unfaithful, which was difficult for me. So we divorced. And so my question is, can I continue to take communion if I am divorced. And then if God blesses me one day with a partner and we choose to marry, will I be able to take communion then also?
Okay, so let me ask a question that I need to clarify. When you got married in your non-denominational service, you were a Catholic at the time, and the gentleman in question was not. Is that he had never been Catholic? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, and did you obtain what's known as a dispensation from form in order to have your non-Catholic service? That would have involved like going to your pastor and saying, we want to have this non-Catholic service. And then he would have filed some paperwork with the bishop and come back and said, yes, you can have this non-Catholic wedding. Did that happen?
No, it did not.
Okay. So you didn't go to your pastor or your bishop or anything like that to get permission, right?
No, okay. I had no idea.
Okay,
no.
Okay. So, and you said this was 8 years ago, so that would have been around 2011. Okay, that's all the information I need to answer your question. The answer is that Catholics, so you know how each state has its laws regarding marriage. So if you're in Texas, you need to observe the laws of Texas. If you're a citizen of Texas and you're in Texas, you need to get married according to Texas law in order to be validly married. And the same thing is true of your church citizenship. So if you're a Catholic, you need to either observe the Catholic form of marriage, which ordinarily means having a wedding in a church, a Catholic church with a priest or a deacon performing it, or you need to get a dispensation so that you can have a non-Catholic marriage. And this is what's known as a dispensation from form. If you don't get a dispensation from form, then if you're a Catholic, then the marriage won't be valid. It's kind of like in some states, if you don't take out a marriage license and you just say vows, it's not going to be valid because you have to get that marriage license first, because the state requires that of their citizens so that it keeps track of the marriages and so forth. Well, the same thing happens in a Catholic context. So if you're a citizen of the Catholic Church, if you're a member of the Catholic Church, you either need to have a Catholic marriage or you need a dispensation to have a non-Catholic marriage. And if you don't, then the Catholic marriage won't be valid. So that means it won't really come into existence in front of God. Now, you might be in good conscience. You might have no clue that you need to do this. And so you may be totally innocent in this. But still, there would have been something blocking the marriage from being valid. That means that if that's what happened in your case, then you're actually not bound to your husband, your civil husband right now. You're just not married to him and really never were, except in the eyes of civil law. And so that means that you're a free woman. Being divorced doesn't mean you can't receive communion. So yeah, you can receive communion now. And if you find a new partner and want to get married, and then the Catholic Church, you know, has no problem with that, you can go ahead and get married. You'll be married to that person at that point, but you can still go on and receive communion because you were free to marry him. So you might need to go through a procedure to show that you're free to marry him. You might need to get an annulment to show, and this is a very easy thing to do in the case of someone who didn't get a dispensation. It's very easy to get an annulment in that case to show that you're free to marry this new person. So there would be a few little formalities that would need to happen for that, but it's totally doable in your situation. Bottom line is, you should consider yourself free and at liberty. You can lead a normal sacramental life as a Catholic. You should go to confession and make a good confession, and then you'd be all set to go on receiving communion. And if you find a new person and marry them, then there may be a little bit of paperwork to make sure everything's taken care of, but that's totally possible and totally fine, and you can totally go on living a normal sacramental life as a Catholic.
Lily,
oh,
I imagine that's good news.
I've heard in such a long time.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
That's great.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Lily, sorry that had to happen to you, but
yeah.
That is great news that now you can receive communion with a clear conscience.
Just be
God
sure to go
you.
To confession. Yeah.
Yep. That's right. We all have to do that, don't we?
Yeah.
Thanks, Lily. All right, heading now to Clayton and watching on YouTube Live. Hello, Clayton. Thanks for waiting, and you're on the air with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, only Catholic in my group, so that's Protestant. So you can see how many...
Okay. Clayton, can you speak directly into the phone? You're breaking up a little bit.
Okay.
Are you there, Clayton?
Clayton?
Can you hear me?
We can. Yeah. Could just then. What's your question in case we lose you?
So my question is on blessing. So in particular, where do priests get their own special authority to do such a thing? And what is the particular reason for getting something blessed?
Okay. The priests... and other people get their authority to perform blessings from the church. Blessings are what are known as sacramentals, and that means they're instituted by the church for spiritual purposes, as opposed to sacraments that were instituted by Christ. So since the church institutes the sacramentals, like blessings, the church can authorize different people to do different blessings. And some blessings are reserved just for a bishop to do. Some are reserved for just priests to do. Some are reserved for bishops, priests, and deacons. And some of them, even lay people, are permitted to do. So it depends on the particular blessing, but when a priest has authorization for a blessing, it's because he's given it by the church. And the place that you would find that is in a document known as the Book of Blessings. This is a collection of many of the different blessings that the Catholic Church has authorized. And at the top of each blessing, it will have an explanation of who the qualified person is to give it. So in some cases, it'll say this blessing can be given by a priest. Or in other cases, it'll say this blessing can be given by a priest, a deacon, or a layperson. In terms of why blessings are given, there are somewhat different understandings of exactly what blessings do, but one thing that everybody can agree on is that they involve asking God to give his grace to people. It may be a particular kind of grace, like if you're asking for if you're a farmer and you want your fields blessed or your farm animals blessed, it's so that they'll be productive, so that you can earn a living with them. You know, you want your crops to grow well. You don't want them to fail. You want your animals to be healthy and reproduce and grow big so you can sell them at market. So it may be a particular blessing like that, or it may be something more general, like you just want more of God's grace in your life. And so the particular purpose of a given blessing may vary, but the general principle is we're asking by the blessing, we're asking God to give us his grace in one form or another.
Thank you, Clayton. We're going to move on here. And we've got next Emma in Cincinnati. And Emma, you're on the air with Jimmy. And Emma, we're going to ask you to be pretty concise about asking your question because we have only a few minutes left.
Thank you. I feel as though the Lord has drawn me to your station. I grew up Catholic, was lucky, blessed enough to be introduced to the guitar masses. Loved it.
Emma, I'm so sorry. Emma, we're going to have to get to your question here. Our Jimmy will not have an opportunity to answer it. Can you just kind of throw that question out there for him?
When Jesus came, he said there was a new law, and I feel as though he told us to love God and love people. Can you expound on that?
Well, so when Jesus refers to a new commandment, he refers to it in John's gospel, in his farewell discourse, as he's getting ready to say goodbye to them. And he says, I give you a new commandment that you are to love one another. And that's not a new commandment in a fundamental sense, because love has been part of God's commandments since the beginning. There's a moment in, say, the Gospel of Matthew, for example, where someone asks Jesus, what's the most important commandment in the law of Moses? And he says that the most important commandment is love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then he says, the second greatest commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. And both of those are found in the law of Moses in the Old Testament. So love of God and love of neighbor are the two most fundamental commandments in the old law. And they are something that that reveals God's ultimate priority for us. When Jesus then says in John's gospel on Holy Thursday, behold, I give you a new commandment that you're to love each other. It's not new in the sense they've never heard it before. It's new in the sense that he's emphasizing it for them right now and saying, listen, this really needs to be part of what you do as Christians. It's new in that you need to take it more seriously and be more aware of this than you have been before. So it's a new commandment in that sense, but it's actually something they already knew before because of the love your neighbor as yourself commandment.
Do you feel as though that is extremely important in our lives today?
Oh, yeah. Since these are the two fundamental commandments, it shows us God's big ultimate priority for us is love. That's what God wants from us. All other commandments, as St. Paul indicates, depend on these, on the love commandments. So everything else, like don't commit adultery and don't kill people, those are just specific applications of the love other people principle. If you love your spouse, you're not going to commit adultery. If you love someone else, you're not going to kill them. So all of it, all of the rest of it centers around the fundamental ethic of love.
Emma, thank you so much for that question. And keep listening to the station, too, listening to Sacred Heart Radio out of Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And, keep growing closer to the Lord. That's what it's all about. So, Jimmy, great working with you again.
Likewise, Sherry. Look forward to the next time.
So do I. Always learn so much working with you, and I know you do as well, dear listeners. So, all right, we are out of time here. Have a wonderful evening. God bless you. I'll be back tomorrow. We'll be talking about evangelization. It's not quite as hard as you think it is. So until tomorrow, many blessings upon you and your family. God bless.
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.